Weeks, the touchy family situation improved, and Patricia moved back home. But Frank, barely 18, remained with his aunt and uncle and enrolled at Salem High. Peg and Ken had a son by Ken's earlier marriage, Kenneth Jr., and they were also taking care of Jackie and Larry Sullivan, whose mother, Carmen Sullivan, one of Peggy and Babe's sisters, had died in childbirth. The boys became close, particularly Frank and Jackie, who were around the same age. This was a much improved family situation for Frank, supported by an economically stable, loving marriage. Dad graduated from Salem High School in 1939 with no immediate plans for college. Despite past problems, the young man missed his parents and sister, and now that he was out of school, he had a yearning to see new places. In the fall of that year, he moved to San Pedro, California, near Los Angeles, where his parents were living. F.H. was chief of the guard force for Los Angeles Shipbuilding and Dry Dock Corporation, an important shipbuilder. Shortly after arriving in California, Junior obtained a newspaper position at the Glendale Star as a copy editor, after lying about his age. He was just 19, but had a way of speaking and carrying himself that enabled him to pass himself off as a man 5 or 6 years older. He smoked a briar pipe, too, which made him look sophisticated. At the Star, there was an old, foul-tempered man who was also a copy editor, and the guy apparently thought that life had passed him by. He sat directly across the desk from an energetic upstart named Frank Herbert. "I was young, and he was old," my father told me later. The old curmudgeon accused Frank of messing up the copy editing on a story that ran in a prior edition, and Frank responded, "You're wrong. I didn't do that. I wasn't even here." Suddenly, the old man grabbed a pair of scissors from the copy desk and went after his younger counterpart, trying to stab him. Thankfully, people jumped in and grabbed the assailant and hauled him away. The fellow continued working there after he calmed down, but my father told me, whenever he had scissors in his hands, I stayed well clear of him. Another copy editor on the paper had his own style of revolt. His tactic was to refuse to bathe for 2 months at a time. He would not change his underwear, socks, or anything. His teeth had green film on them. People really kept their distance. My father would accumulate many more interesting characters and stories in more than 3 decades in the newspaper business, a profession that for him was a window on the world. Fascinating, but low-paying. Journalism kept him on the leading edge of events, filling his hunger for political information and arming him with political data he would use in his science fiction writing. Always impulsive, in the summer of 1940, he moved back to Salem, Oregon. For a short while, he lived with the Roundtrees again while looking for a newspaper job. He approached the Oregon Statesman for a position, but was told by the personnel manager that no openings were available. After finding out who the managing editor of the paper was, the would-be journalist went to the man's house and accosted him in his front yard. The managing editor, Steve Mergler, was at first irritated, but the young man had a convincing way about him. Frank Herbert asked if he could fill in when other reporters, copy editors, or photographers were on vacation. He had his own photographic equipment and said he could even perform copy boy duties if necessary. "I can do a lot of things," he told Mergler. "I can be like a utility man on a baseball team, playing whatever position you need." This sounded intriguing to Mergler, who had an eye for good people and appreciated an enterprising young man. So Frank, just shy of his 20th birthday, went on call for the paper. He came in at all hours, did anything he was asked to do. He even worked in the advertising and subscription departments. He did everything so well, in fact, with such dedication and excellence, that it wasn't long before he was working full-time. His principal responsibilities involved photography, and since this was the state capital, many of his assignments involved political events. One of his photographs, at a charity fundraiser called the Salem Chest, was of U.S. Senator Douglas McKay, who would later become Secretary of the Interior. McKay took a liking to the young man, which later proved beneficial to Frank. In Salem, Frank Herbert became enamored with airplanes and flying. He worked every angle to get into the air as a passenger, both for pleasure and on news assignments. These were small planes, single-engine two-seaters. In nearly 14 months on the Oregon Statesman, Dad also reported, worked as copy editor and night editor, and wrote feature stories. In feature writing, he learned the importance of characterization, of clearly defining a person and determining what makes him tick. This, he would come to realize one day, was a central feature in any good novel. He spent as much time as he could in the outdoors, recharging himself, as he described it many years later. There were ski trips with friends to nearby slopes in the Oregon Cascades, and a number of fishing trips to Elk Lake in the Three Sisters Wilderness area. He took a canoe to Elk Lake in 1941 with a young friend, Fram Morgan. Soon afterward, Morgan joined the U.S. Marines. He was killed in the first wave at Tarawa in 1943, fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. When my father wanted something, be it a job or a relationship, he was not to be denied. An impatient, driven man, he always found a way to get from point A to point B. While working in Salem in the spring of 1941, he met and fell in love with Flora Parkinson, a teenager. In June, they wanted to get married, and Frank thought it would be nice if they held the ceremony in his hometown, Tacoma, Washington. On impulse, they drove 300 miles north. At the courthouse in Tacoma, the only judge available, Judge W.A. Richmond, was conducting police court, and a number of men who had been accused of public intoxication were waiting for their cases to be heard. Undeterred, Frank, with his bride-to-be in tow, marched up to the judge and asked him in a low tone if he would marry them. Judge Richmond appeared surprised, but he smiled and told the couple to take seats and wait. Then he hurried through a number of cases, convicting every defendant. When these matters were disposed of, he performed the wedding in front of a courtroom packed with police court spectators. That month, Nazi Germany attacked Russia. The war in Europe was escalating. The pages of the Oregon Statesman were filled with news of those events and speculation about whether the United States would enter the conflict. Another move followed, and in October 1941, the Herbert newlyweds found themselves living in San Pedro, California, near my grandparents' apartment. Flora was pregnant. Dad went back to work for the Glendale Star, this time as a reporter and photographer. His love affair with flying continued, and he went on many aerial assignments and personal flights as a passenger. He took at least 5,000 aerial photographs. With U.S. involvement in World War II in December 1941, my grandfather's position as chief of the guard force for Los Angeles Shipbuilding and Dry Dock became even more important, as it was directly related to the war effort. The yard was building a number of big Navy ships. All over the United States, young men and women rushed to recruiting offices. Dad obtained enlistment papers from a Navy recruiter, but delayed signing them because of his family responsibilities. Of all the military branches, the Navy appealed to him most, from his love of ships and the sea. F.H., aside from his guard duties, got together with a fire department friend to invent and patent what they called the Durabomb Shovel, which was used by Los Angeles Shipbuilding and Dry Dock and by Douglas Aircraft. The shovel had a hollow handle, filled with sand to smother blazes, and a snow shovel-shaped bottom with a hinged lid. It was designed for fighting magnesium incendiary bomb fires, the sort expected to be used by the Japanese if they ever reached our coast. When an incendiary bomb hit, the theory went, a firefighter would rush to the scene, smother the flames with sand, scoop the bomb up, and carry it away. On February 15th, 1942, Frank Herbert, Jr. registered for the draft in Los Angeles County. According to his draft card, he was 5'10" and rather thin at 150 pounds. He still had the scar over his right eye and into his eyebrow, the half-inch-long mark from the Malamute dog attack. The following day, on February 16th, a baby girl, Penelope Penny Eileen, was born to the couple. Dad selected the mythological name Penelope from the faithful wife of Odysseus, who spurned numerous suitors during the hero's absence from Troy. The baby's middle name, Eileen, was my paternal grandmother's given name. In July 1942, unable to wait any longer, Frank enlisted in the U.S. Navy. He gave the recruiting officer a letter of recommendation from the supervisor of shipbuilding at Los Angeles Shipbuilding and Dry Dock, a retired U.S. Navy officer. During his physical examination for the Navy, the doctor kept looking out the window at another doctor and two pretty nurses who were waiting in a convertible with golf clubs visible. Anxious to join them, the doctor rushed Dad through. Frank Herbert was assigned to the huge Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Portsmouth, Virginia, where he served as a photographer second class V6 in the U.S. Naval Reserve. His mother, Babe, was extremely worried about him and spent many nights crying. In boot camp, Dad first encountered the Blue Jackets Manual. One of the entries on swimming went like this. Breathing may be accomplished by swimming with the head out of water. Another entry, under the section on ships. Question: what is the part of the ship known as midships? Answer: the middle part. And this one: it is most important that all appliances for securing water tightness be kept in an efficient condition. The foolishness of such passages in this bureaucratically produced manual later became the inspiration for his short story, By the Book, 1966. He also picked up a number of mottos on the base. If you can pick it up, pick it up. If you can't pick it up, paint it. If it moves, salute it. Or, keep your mouth shut, your bowels open, and never volunteer. And, fire at will. This one particularly amused him, because he considered it unfair to treat anyone named Will in this manner. Despite his rating as a photographer, he did more office work than anything else, and increased his typing speed. This skill would prove beneficial to him in journalism and in his creative writing career. He also became quite a poker player in the service, which provided him with an additional source of income. Most of his money was sent home to San Pedro for his wife and baby. One of the fellows in Dad's outfit was going steady with a girl back home. The young man didn't drink, gamble, or carouse. He sent money back to his girl, and she was supposed to bank it for their future marriage. One day he received a Dear John letter from her, and she requested the return of her picture. My father, ever impish, came up with a method of retaliation for his buddy. He collected 50 or 60 pictures of girlfriends from the guys in the outfit, and then dictated a letter to her from the jilted man. I was disappointed to receive your letter. I'm all broken up by it. There is only one problem. I can't remember which girl you are. From this stack of pictures, will you please pick out the one of you and send the rest back? Money for return postage is enclosed. In the winter of 1942, Dad received his own Dear John letter from Flora, in which she told him she wanted a divorce. Devastated, he was brought to tears and felt frustrated at having to deal with a situation from 3,000 miles away. One night while on bivouac, with his mind on personal problems, he tripped over a tent tie-down and fell, hitting his head. A soft, lumpy blood clot developed on top of his skull, and he was warned by the doctor not to hit that spot again at risk of his life, and to let the clot dissolve. With the assistance of his uncle Ken Roundtree, he was given an early honorable discharge from the service in March 1943, less than 8 months after enlisting. Colonel Kenneth Roundtree Sr. was a commanding officer at Fort Worden in Port Townsend, Washington during World War II. He also wrote an artillery handbook that was used for years as a textbook at West Point. He caught a military transport home to the West Coast. With a bandage on his head, he returned home to San Pedro, but discovered that Flora had disappeared, taking the baby with her. Driving north to Bandon, Oregon, he visited the home of Flora's mother. In tears, he said to her, "All I want is my family back. Where are they?" She wouldn't tell him, and despondent, he left. Later, she confided to my half-sister Penny, "I almost told him, but I thought it would be a mistake for them to be together." Flora obtained custody of Penny. Later, my father would say that the letter from Flora was one of the luckiest things that ever happened to him, since it led ultimately to meeting my mother. But that remained several years off, and he would go through a painful period of adjustment. He moved back to his roots in the Pacific Northwest. From August 1943 to August 1945, he worked as a copy editor for the Oregon Journal in Portland, Oregon. This region, with its familiar landscapes and outdoor way of life, soothed his troubled spirit. The copy desk at the Oregon Journal was in the shape of a half circle. Along the outer rim of the desk, called the rim, the copy editor sat, marking up stories that came in over the wires and stories written by staff reporters. On the other side of the desk, inside the curve, sat the slot man, sometimes referred to as the dealer. He dealt stories to the copy editors. The United Press International office in the back had some tape-punching machines, which were in intermittent use. They were for transmitting stories to other UPI offices around the world. To send a story, it had to be typed on a special tape and held until the designated hours of transmission began. Then the tape was fed through the machine, printing the story on both the originating and receiving machines. So over a couple of days, in odd moments, my impish father went back and cut the tape to print so that it would look like a standard UPI story. It was one of the wildest stories you ever heard. There is an apocryphal tale about Dad that the story he faked on the machine concerned a UFO attack on Europe, in which the cities were destroyed with green death rays. It is not difficult to imagine how this tale came about, since it circulated decades later when my father was the most famous science fiction writer in the world. The essence of the actual story he punched out on the UPI machine was that an American flying ace was revealed to have previously been an ace for the Nazi Air Force, the Luftwaffe. Supposedly, when he was a German flyer, he was shot down over North Africa, then brought to the United States as a prisoner of war. But he had been an Austrian professor before the war, and with the assistance of academic friends in the United States, he secured false identity papers and escaped from the prisoner of war camp. Subsequently, he enlisted in the U.S. Air Force under this false identity. The last line of the story read, "Any resemblance between the foregoing and anything that may have actually happened is purely coincidental." The slot man at the time of the gag, Fred McNeil, was absolutely authoritarian, without a sense of humor. Behind him sat a copy spike, a sharp steel prong where copy boys impaled stories as they came in from the wire machines and reporters. The copy boy would come and spike a story on it, and without looking back, McNeil would just grab the piece and start working on it. Most of the people in the office knew about the gag, and Frank even had the UPI people in on it. One dull afternoon, they had a machine free so that he could run his tape on it. The tape told the machine what to do, and it printed the story on standard UPI paper, an original and two carbons. It wasn't transmitted. It only took a minute or so. The tape went fairly fast. Then the prankster ripped the story off, walked back to the copy desk as though coming from the John, spiked it, and slid back into his seat on the rim. Meanwhile, McNeil grabbed the story and put it down in front of him. The staff members watched him out of the corners of their eyes. It was a slack time of day with very little copy, so Frank was betting that McNeil would copy edit it himself and not deal it, as he often did at slow times. He behaved predictably. He sat there with his copy pencil marking the story. Marking it, and saying, "My God, for God's sakes!" He glanced at the clock and shouted to the wire editor, who was in on the gag, "We'd better try for a page one remake." McNeil was editing fast to get down to the bottom, and then he read that line. The flush started at the back of his neck and went right up over his head. He rose to his feet, balled up the paper, and heaved it across the room with an angry grunt. "If I ever find the son of a bitch who did that," he shouted, "I'll kill him." In 1943, Dad hadn't been doing much fiction writing of any type, and it had been this way since 1938, when hubris had led him to believe, incorrectly, that he had developed a formula for writing westerns. The war and his unsuccessful marriage further distracted him. But with the stability of the Oregon Journal job, he began writing again, before and after work. His efforts were rewarded as he sold a clever 2,000-word suspense yarn to Esquire, Survival of the Cunning, published in the March 1945 issue. They paid him $200, a substantial sum for a short story in those days. Set during World War II, it described a fictional U.S. Army sergeant sent to the Alaskan Arctic wilderness to locate a Japanese radio and weather station. A bad situation developed, in which the sergeant and his Eskimo guide were captured by a Japanese soldier who had an automatic pistol. The Japanese, however, had committed the error of letting his gun warm up in the moist atmosphere of a cabin before taking it outside. Wisely, the Eskimo knew the gun would freeze up in the sub-zero Arctic air outside, and he was able to overcome the captor. My father had a lifelong fascination with remote regions of the earth, from frozen locales to tropics to deserts. Desolate beauty appealed to him, the serenity of the wilderness. He had not journeyed to the Arctic before writing the Esquire story, but wrote nonetheless in a convincing fashion from research, from stories that had come through newspaper offices, and from his imagination. He developed a knack for traveling in his mind, for transporting himself far away from the room in which he sat at a manual typewriter. In August 1945, he left the Oregon Journal and took a position on the night rewrite desk of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. This was a Hearst paper, one of a nationwide chain that maintained a steady drumbeat against Japanese Americans during the war. In large part, the Hearst news organs were responsible for sentiment against American citizens of Japanese descent and their mistreatment. But now the war was ending, and more rational moods were setting in. Frank Herbert's boyhood buddy, Dan Lodholm, was in the U.S. Coast Guard during the war.
When Dan returned to the Northwest after his stint in the service, my father gave him and a number of Coast Guard war heroes a first-class tour of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspaper plant in downtown Seattle.
They were suitably impressed. Using GI Bill financial assistance, Frank enrolled at the University of Washington in Seattle for the fall quarter of 1945. Without much regard to a major, he intended to take writing classes while still holding down his newspaper job. Soon, he would fall head over heels for a brunette Scottish-American girl in the same creative writing class. Chapter 4. But he's so blonde. When Frank Herbert worked at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer in 1945 and 1946, he rented a room in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Ronald Hooper, near the Montlake Cut in Seattle. While Frank was at work one evening, the Hoopers held a piano recital, at which Mr. Hooper played the piano, and a well-known Russian-born artist, Jacob Elshin, sang baritone. One of the guests was a red-haired teenager named Howard Howie Hansen, who was part Quileute Indian. Just before the recital began, Howie heard Hooper's wife tell someone, "We have a nice young newspaper man renting a room in the basement. His name is Frank Herbert." The atmosphere at the recital was painfully formal, with much posturing and phony conversation. Many attendees sat with exaggerated erectness and chit-chatted, their little fingers sticking out as they held wine goblets. Dad wandered in at around 11 p.m. For 20 minutes he listened to the singing, which seemed off-key to him, and noticed the hypocrisy and superficiality of the guests. I think my father must have been a little tired, or perhaps something didn't go well at work, because suddenly he dispensed with civility and announced rather loudly, "I'd like to show you what this reminds me of." "Oh," Mrs. Hooper said with a smile, "and what is it you do?" "An ape act," Frank said. Thereupon he jumped on the sofa and began hopping from one end to the other in street shoes, curling his arms like a chimpanzee and making simian sounds. "Oomph, oomph, oomph." Everyone looked at him in stunned disbelief, except Howie, who could barely contain his laughter. Presently, Frank left the room, saying, "That's what I think of what I saw here tonight." The next day, he was invited to move out. So my father lost a place to live, but he gained a lifelong friend and kindred spirit in Howie Hansen. "I was just off the reservation and pretty wild," Howie said to me later. "Maybe that's why Frank liked me." Howie, born in late 1931, was only 14 years old when they met, but was intellectually quite mature. Frank developed the good-natured practice of calling him hard at times, and would later even autograph books to him that way. With his stepfather's approval, Howie invited Frank to live with them on a houseboat, moored near the Ballard Locks in Seattle. A short time later, their new tenant showed up with a pickup truck full of items and began unloading. He had books, skis, a microscope, footlockers, clothes, and articles of furniture piled high in the back of the truck. When Howie's stepfather saw all of that, he exclaimed, "My God, he'll sink us." So Frank lost another place to live, but with the assistance of Howie, arrangements were made for substitute quarters at the home of John Gerke Jr. in the Ballard District. Howie wanted to travel the world by ship and tried to talk his new friend into joining the U.S. Merchant Marine with him. They would vagabond to distant, exotic parts of the world. This was tempting to my father, because he dearly loved the sea and wanted to learn everything he could about the world. But he enjoyed the newspaper business and was planning to take writing classes soon at the University of Washington. He didn't say no, and he didn't say yes. They often went on trips out into the countryside, and Dad always took a camera along and a book. "He was always reading and showing me things in books," Howie recalled. Upon hearing this, I thought of a boyhood description of my father when he was some 15 years younger, at a time when he was always seen in the company of a book. He hadn't changed, and never would. They talked about opening a camera supply store together. Frank went to Portland to contact suppliers, but was delayed there when he met a girl he thought he liked. A few days later, he returned to Seattle and told Howie she was a dullwit. In March 1946, the Post Intelligencer laid Frank Herbert off, citing obligations to returning World War II combat veterans. He had not been in combat. In a creative writing class, English 139, he sat next to an attractive, dark-haired girl, Beverly Forbes. She had a shy way of looking at him with dark blue, half-closed eyes, and she spoke in soft tones, selecting her words carefully. Her laugh was gentle, and sometimes she broke into a girlish, nervous giggle. Smitten, Frank told Howie, "I've just met a Scottish girl with the most beautiful black hair." Actually, she was Scottish-American, born Beverly Stewart prior to her mother's remarriage to a man named David Forbes. Like Frank, she read extensively. Her interest in literature went back to her early childhood, when her maternal grandfather, Cooper Landis, introduced her to classic books. Cooper had once been the traveling secretary of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Beverly told her best friend, Frankie Goodwin, about the young man she had met in writing class, Frank Herbert. Coincidentally, She was struck by his hair, as he had been with hers. "It's beautiful," she said, "the color of molten gold." He dressed casually but neatly, typically in a black or dark turtleneck shirt, with a jacket zipped up to the center of his chest. His hair was long and neatly combed, straight back at the sides and across the top. He parted it on the left side, where my natural part is. The hair had a slight uplift on top, rising to his right. He began a pattern of pursuit. He learned where Beverly Forbes ate lunch, and then just happened to wander by at the right moment with his own lunch. He found out where she studied in the library, and when. They discussed great books and writing, and found they shared an interest in the classics, history, and poetry. They shared another interest as well, an important one. Each wanted to be a writer. Both were working students, he at the newspaper, and she as an ad-writing trainee for the Clark Richards Advertising Agency in Tacoma. They were also the only students in the class who had sold anything. Dad's Survival of the Cunning had been published the year before by Esquire, and during the course he sold another story, The Jonah and the Jap, to Doc Savage magazine, published in the April 1946 issue. Like the Esquire story, it was set in World War II, involving characters who developed a clever means of outwitting the Japanese. In 1946, Beverly sold a story entitled Corner Movie Girl to Modern Romances magazine, for which she received $145. The editor told her she liked the sincerity of the story, but thought the plot was a little weak. Corner Movie Girl was written as an assignment for the creative writing class she was taking, and it was read before the class and critiqued by her peers and by the instructor. Following a number of suggestions, including some from the blonde young man who sat next to her, she rewrote the story. Corner Movie Girl described a plain young woman who was envious of her beautiful friend for the proposals her friend constantly received from men. The plain girl dreamed of falling in love with the heir to a fortune. Subsequently, she dated a rich, handsome young fellow, and they went to a fancy place to dance. But the experience left her feeling emotionally unsatisfied, and she felt cheapened for having done it. She returned to her plain, ordinary, no-frills guy, the one she really loved. My mother's story was semi-autobiographical, as many first stories are. She had been overweight during most of her life before college, which made her feel unattractive. She never dreamed of getting a rich husband, though. Idealistic, she always intended to marry for love. Upon meeting Frank Herbert, an experienced man about town, she was 19, romantic, and somewhat naive concerning affairs of the heart. She wrote true confession stories of love. My father called them sin, suffer, and repent stories. He wrote pulp adventures. She was the romantic, very feminine, and he the adventurer, strong and rugged. Both were dreamers, but neither could have had any inkling of the remarkable life they would spend together. Frank was having trouble with university officials. He was studying psychology, mathematics, and English, including creative writing, but wanted to select classes as if they were arrayed on a smorgasbord. He insisted upon taking a disproportionate number of psychology courses and tried to skip introductory classes, going straight to advanced material. He already knew the preparatory stuff, he told the registrar, and didn't want to waste his time. But the bureaucrats running the school said he couldn't do as he pleased, despite straight-A grades. Besides, they said, he wasn't taking the classes necessary to qualify for a major, and everyone had to have a major. My mother had always thought she would marry a dark-haired man like her father, while her friend Frankie expected to marry a blonde. One evening, Frankie and Beverly were talking alone. "Do you like him?" Beverly inquired. "Yes," came the response. "But he's so blonde." Beverly invited Frank to a Shakespearean play at the university, Macbeth. She was playing the third witch in heavy makeup. The playhouse was at the corner of 43rd and University in Seattle, on the second floor over a dance studio. Frank went with Howie. After the performance, Beverly's blue eyes teared up, and she said to Frank, "I was just acting like a witch, and don't want you to think I'm that kind of a person." "Oh, no," he responded. "I don't think that. I mean, I understand." They made arrangements to go somewhere later that evening. While she changed out of her costume, Dad walked Howie to the bus stop on University Avenue. Howie recognized the symptoms he was witnessing, that his friend had come to life. As they made their way along the sidewalk, Howie said, "Frank, you're going to marry that girl, and you're going to end your days together." In response, my father laughed as only he could laugh. As Howie put it, he let out a haw-haw boom that filled the caverns between buildings. And Frank Herbert said, "There isn't a chance in a million, Howie. I have no intention whatsoever of getting married again." But his young companion said again, "Frank, that's Mrs. Herbert right there. That's the future Mrs. Herbert." "No," Dad said, shaking his head. "Once is enough, and it didn't work out for me. That's it for me." His divorce from Flora had been finalized some 3 years before, but the trauma had remained with him. The next day, Frank and Howie went to Kingston on the Olympic Peninsula by ferry and looked at an A-frame they were thinking of purchasing together. On the way back, they were sitting on the beach, waiting for a ferry boat. Dad mentioned a popular song by the Inkspots, "I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire," and said, "I don't want to set the world on fire, Howie. I just want to make the grass wave a little as I go by."
The comment was also reminiscent of the poetry of Ezra Pound, which my father read voraciously. "And life slips by like a field mouse, not shaking the grass."
2 weeks later, Frank called Howie and asked, "Will you stand for me as best man at our wedding?" Howie laughed and consented. The wedding would be held in a few months, in June. Frustrated with university rules concerning degree requirements, Frank Herbert decided to drop out the following June in 1946. His wedding was scheduled for the same month.
My father had a way of springing wild plans on people.
Shortly before their wedding, he found an unusual situation in which they could honeymoon and make a little money at the same time. He would be a fire watcher for the Forest Service atop a 5,402-foot mountain in Washington State's Snoqualmie National Forest, with permission for his young wife to accompany him. The lookout cabin, similar to the one later occupied by the Beat Generation icon Jack Kerouac, was perched on rugged Kelly Butte in the middle of a federal forest, 30 miles northeast of Mount Rainier. This was in the Cascade Mountain Range, which divides the eastern and western portions of the state. The job would last from early summer through mid-fall 1946 and would pay $33 a week. "I didn't hesitate for an instant," my mother recalled later. "When Frank told me about it, I just said yes." She was ready for the first adventure of their long married life. Or thought she was. On Sunday afternoon, June 23, 1946, this date is based upon the marriage certificate, in the dedication to Chapter House Dune, the date was shown incorrectly as June 20, 1946. My parents were married by a minister in the front parlor of a house on Seattle's Queen Anne Hill. They exchanged simple gold wedding bands. Howie Hansen was best man. For years afterward, whenever Howie said to someone, "I was best man at Frank's wedding," my father would quip, "He was the second best man. I was the best man." And Frankie Goodwin, the maid of honor. A reception followed in the home. Only a dozen people were in attendance, including the parents of the bride and groom. My father did not like large weddings. Besides, he had grown independent of his extended family since achieving his majority, largely because so many of them were judgmental, and he didn't care to seek their approval. On his paternal side, the Herberts saw people in either white hats or black hats, with nothing in between. On his maternal side, the McCarthys, devout Catholics, had expressed disapproval over his divorce from his first wife. Up to that time, Frank Herbert's life had been a paradigm of failure and instability. In addition to difficulties in school, marriage, and the Navy, he had lost his job with the Post-Intelligencer. Contributing to his problems, his parents had not always provided a wholesome family environment for him. At last, he was with a nurturing person, a potential lifelong companion, in a relationship that could enable him to fully realize his potential. In early July 1946, the newlyweds climbed Kelly Butte and remained there until late October. Each week, Dad hiked down to the nearest town of Leicester for supplies, and then returned to the mountaintop, a round trip that took him 10 or 11 hours. Strong and barrel-chested, he was an excellent hiker and could carry a heavy pack. The lookout cabin, a 12-foot-square, hip-roofed structure at the pinnacle of Kelly Butte, had a 360-degree view of the surrounding mountains and forests. They had no electricity or indoor plumbing, but water was plentiful, obtained from a small lake in the midst of a meadow on the butte. They had an outhouse that was in good repair, except the door didn't latch well and sometimes blew open in strong winds. The wood stove didn't draft properly, and under certain wind conditions, the cabin filled with smoke. In this excerpt from a 1,500-word piece my mother wrote about the adventure, she described her first impression of their living quarters. Finally, we sat down on the bed. The cooler had been nailed on the north side of the cabin, and surveyed our home. Our 144 square feet of home, with 24 windows looking into the fog, and a ladder that slanted over the bed to the cupola. On the south wall across from us hung a shovel, an axe, a laundry bag, firefighting pack, 40 number of potatoes, and a washboard. So we started looking for a washtub. There wasn't any. We refused to think about it then. Instead, we looked at the stove. We wished we hadn't. It was squat, dirty, black, and looked stubborner than hell. She entitled the piece, with tongue firmly planted in cheek, "Look Out," a reference to the perils of honeymooning in a Forest Service lookout station. It formed the first chapter of what she and Ed hoped would be a collaborative book. They never completed the book or published any part of it. His contribution, 2,000 words long, included the following passage. "Oh yes, the scenery is beautiful. Our regal neighbor, Mount Rainier, looks in the window every clear day, seemingly just across the valley from us. The flowers are in bloom in the mountain meadows around us, the Indian paintbrush, the lupin, the daisies, and even the mock orange. Deer pasture in the meadow, too. Bear drink at our lake, and the ground squirrels chase each other under our cabin. On a clear night, we can even see Seattle, a mellow glow in the sky." On a Victrola hauled in by pack mule, my parents listened to classical, jazz, and swing music. In the evenings, they read or played cards by the light of a kerosene lamp. They developed their own card game, a two-hand version of Hearts, in which they played and drew, so that no one knew where all the hearts were. The young couple wrote short stories at every opportunity, sitting separately with typewriters set up on footlockers. His stories were pulp adventures, and hers romances. Mom also composed an unpublished poem about what it might be like to trade places with her new husband and look back at herself. "If I were you and you were me, I'd lie flat on my back and sing, to see you sitting where I am, writing this silly thing." She often curled up on a pillow with a good book and a red and white pack of Lucky Strike cigarettes that were cellophane-wrapped and bore the company slogan LSMFT. Lucky Strike means fine tobacco. Invariably, she tucked a book of matches into the cellophane wrapper. She had been smoking since the age of 14 and had a constant, nervous need to be doing something with her hands. If she wasn't holding a cigarette, she enjoyed knitting or crocheting. Dad found occasion to utilize his hunting skills on Kelly Butte. He hadn't brought along a rifle, but did have a .38 pistol, an Ivor Johnson five-banger. Early one afternoon, near the northern boundary of the Butte, he spotted a blue grouse in a clump of shrubbery. With scarcely a moment's hesitation, he drew his pistol and blew the head off the grouse, thus avenging an earlier insult committed against his father by another of that breed. The honeymooners prepared a fine meal with the fowl that evening. One day, after transmitting the location of a fire to the dispatcher and to all other lookout towers in the area, Mom forgot and left the microphone open. Dad was preparing to make the trek into Lester, and she was going over the grocery list with him. She read the list aloud, saying, 3 pounds of flour, 2 dozen eggs, fresh carrots. Oh my God, there's a bear. She had spotted a large black bear outside as she spoke. Subsequently, they received cards and letters from fire watchers, rangers, and others who had heard the broadcast and were amused by it. On warm summer days, they were in the habit of hauling mattresses outside and making love on the walk-around ramp of the lookout at sunset, with a golden glow around Mount Rainier. I was conceived on that porch. When they saw Howie Hansen a few days later in Seattle, Dad said to him, proudly, "Just feel these muscles in my back, from carrying a pack up and down hills." Howie felt them. They were hard and taut, like cords. "Do you know what we did up there?" Dad said. "We conceived a child." "The biggest fire in the woods was us," Mom added. Chapter 5. The White Witch. One May afternoon in 1947, when my mother was very pregnant with me, she found herself overwhelmed by a craving for watermelon. The grocery store was only a couple of blocks away in the Queen Anne district of Seattle, so she walked there and made the purchase. On the way back, she noticed a man and woman in a car looking at her and laughing. She had been carrying the watermelon in front of her belly and didn't realize how funny it looked. Before dawn, a few weeks later, the time came to rush her to Maynard Hospital. As my father wrote years later in a special dedication to my mother, they were in a silly, joyful mood as they entered the hospital. They laughed and giggled as they walked down the corridors, holding hands. Their ebullience drew surprised stares, since hospitals were, after all, supposed to be serious, sober places. I was born on June 29th. My parents brought me home from the hospital on Independence Day, July 4th, 1947, a year to the date from the day they trekked up Kelly Butte to their honeymoon roost. As Mom walked in the door of the house with me and realized how much work she would have to do with a new baby, she thought, "This is independence?" Like my father, I had shining golden hair as a child. My given name, Brian, is Gaelic, meaning one who is nobly descended and honorable, also one who is fair-spoken and wordy. My middle name, Patrick, stems from St. Patrick, credited in legend with having driven all the snakes out of Ireland. A larger design was at work as well. My parents' first child was to have an Irish Catholic name, after my father's Irish lineage on the McCarthy side. The second child was to take on a Scottish given and middle name, following my mother's Presbyterian Stuart lineage. During the early years of his marriage to my mother, Dad worked for a number of newspapers. By late 1947, he was employed as a feature writer for the Tacoma Times. He had grown a beard, and when going out on assignments in the blustery northwest weather, often wore a trench coat and fedora, while carrying a large Kodak medalist camera slung over one shoulder. In my father's lifetime, there were many incidents involving his driving. He was, in fact, something of a notorious motor vehicle operator wherever he lived, mostly involving speeding incidents. In some neighborhoods, people learned to watch out for him as he raced by and reined in their children and pets. If someone were to ask me if he was a good driver, however, I would have to admit, with all candor, yes, but he scared the hell out of me. He had remarkably good reactions, something inherited by my older sister Penny, who became, among her other accomplishments, a trophy-winning Jeep racer. Like my father and sister, I too have excellent reactions. There are a number of stories in our family when those reactions came into play. Nothing compares, however, with the occasion in 1948 when my father was driving his mother-in-law Marguerite's big 1937 Oldsmobile. I, barely a year old, sat on the back seat with my Nana Marguerite, while my mother and father sat in front. Dad claimed for years afterward that he came around the fateful turn at only 45 miles an hour, but one of the passengers told it differently. According to my mother, none of us were wearing seatbelts, and he had the olds going more than 70. She'd been watching the speedometer climb, but had not said anything to him about it. It was a two-lane highway. They rounded a turn and were suddenly confronted with a flimsy 2x4 barricade in front of a bridge, with the workers sitting alongside the road having lunch. Pieces of bridge deck were missing. Dad could either go off the road or attempt a daredevil jump over the gap. He decided in a split second to attempt a leap, similar to one he had seen performed by a circus clown at the wheel of a tiny motorized car. He floored the accelerator. The big car crashed through the barricade onto bridge decking, then went airborne for an instant before all four rubber tires smacked down on the other side. Frank Herbert stopped the car and waved merrily to the stunned workers, then sped off. "What fun!" Mom exclaimed. But she lit a cigarette nervously and noticed her hands shaking. Uncharacteristically, Marguerite was quiet in the back and admitted later she'd been terrified. It all happened so quickly. She said she barely had time to grab me. My father said at least 8 solutions appeared before him when he rounded the turn and saw the barricade, in what could not have amounted to more than a tenth of a second. He compared it with a dream, in which a series of events that seemed to take a long time were in reality crammed into only a few seconds. During the emergency, he weighed each option calmly and decided upon the one that worked. He said he visualized the successful leap. It has been said that art imitates life. Years later, in his 1968 novel, The Santa Rosa Barrier, he fictionalized the event. He rounded a corner and came parallel with the river. Ahead stood the clump of willows and the long down-sweeping curve to the bridge. Desine stepped on the throttle. The truck entered the curve. The road was banked nicely. The bridge came into view. There was a yellow truck parked off the road at the far side, men standing behind it drinking out of metal cups. "Look out!" Piaget shouted. In that instant, Desine saw the reason for the truck. A gaping hole in the center of the bridge where the planks had been removed. That was a county work crew, and they'd opened at least a 10-foot hole in the bridge. The truck sped some 40 feet during the moment it took Desine to realize his peril. Now, he could see a 2x4 stretched across each end of the bridge, yellow warning flags tied at their centers. Desine gripped the steering wheel. His mind shifted into a speed of computation he had never before experienced. The effect was to slow the external passage of time. The truck seemed to come almost to a stop while he reviewed the possibilities. Hit the brakes? No. Brakes and tires were old. At this speed, the truck would skid onto the bridge and into the hole. Swerve off the road? No. The river waited on both sides, a deep cut in the earth to swallow them. Aim for a bridge abutment to stop the truck? Not at this speed, and without seatbelts. Hit the throttle to increase speed? That was a possibility. There was the temporary barrier to break through, but that was only a 2x4. The bridge rose in a slight arc up and over the river. The hole had been opened in the center. Given enough speed, the truck could leap the hole. Desine jammed the throttle to the floorboards. The old truck leaped ahead. There came a sharp cracking sound as they smashed through the barrier. Planks clattered beneath the wheels. There came a breathless instant of flying, a spring-crushing lurch as they landed across the hole, the crack of the far barrier. He hit the brakes, came to a screeching stop opposite the workmen. Time resumed its normal pace as Design stared out at the crew. 5 men, faces pale, mouths agape. Frank Herbert received only a few moving violations in the many years he drove, covering what must have amounted to millions of miles. One ticket was for failing to dim his headlights for oncoming traffic. Another involved following too closely and running into the rear of another vehicle. But that occurred on an icy street. I also remember how he backed out of driveways or narrow dead-end streets, going hell-bent for leather with his head out the driver's window, staring back intently or looking in the side mirror. He learned some of his high-speed driving skills from his father, who had been a highway patrolman. When barreling down a narrow, winding road, he didn't slow at the turns, and instead beeped furiously. If anything was coming, it had to get out of the way. He knew how to minimize wear on automobile mechanisms, too. When driving a vehicle with a clutch, each time he had to stop on a steep hill, he set the emergency brake and then released it slowly as he started out, thus putting less wear on the clutch. He never rode the clutch and could double-clutch into low gear with gearboxes that didn't have synchromesh. As a child, I always felt he was in total control, and I don't recall ever feeling at risk. In my adulthood, however, when I knew him a bit too well, I often feared for my life while riding in a car with him at the wheel. Dad and Mom took frequent fishing trips together, while I remained with my Nana Marguerite, who was a well-known Northwest watercolor artist. She had a large studio in her home where she painted beach and boat scenes and landscapes. On one such fishing trip, my parents were on a river near North Bend, Washington. During the day, Dad had been off fishing, performing his hunting and gathering role, while Mom worked around their rented cabin. When he returned with his catch, he discovered he had lost a packet containing fishing flies and hooks that had been given to him by one of his grandparents. It had sentimental as well as practical value, and he was upset. She told him not to worry, that she would find it. He had been all over the river fishing, not staying in one place at all. Still, she led him directly to an area of unusual rocks, where she knelt over a hole, reached in, and retrieved the missing gear. "It was there that I discovered I was married to a white witch," he told me. Another time, in her University of Washington years, her friend Frankie called to say she had lost a gold ring. Beverly told her to go back to Parrington Hall on the campus, where she would find the ring on top of a towel dispenser in the ladies' restroom. Frankie checked, and there it was. In coming years, Dad would rely upon Mom's ability to find things for him, and upon her power to forecast events. Chapter 6. The Jungian Connection. Mom's mother, Marguerite Forbes, gave us a piece of property on Vashon Island, near Seattle and Tacoma. When I was around a year old, Dad started construction on a small home there, with Mom helping. Unfortunately, we ran out of funds. The home, half completed, was repossessed by the bank, along with the land. Early in 1949, Dad accepted a job with the Santa Rosa Press Democrat in Sonoma County, California, just north of San Francisco. This was just one of many moves we would make during my childhood. In all, we lived in 23 different places. I remember how books filled our little rented house in Santa Rosa, in bookcases in the living room, in the kitchen, and in my parents' bedroom. One of my earliest memories, when I was a toddler, was of my mother looking patiently up from a book on her lap as I spoke to her. She taught me that books were sacred. I was never to dog-ear pages or write on them. My father and mother had many friends, and when they came over, Dad told stories. Heavy laughter often accompanied what he was saying. One regular visitor to our home was Bernard Zakheim, a Polish-born Jew who was a painter and sculptor. Bernard lived in Sebastopol, California, where he owned an old farmhouse with a large apple orchard. They met when Dad did a press Democrat story about a terracotta figure Bernard had cast from one of his wood carvings. The figure, which I have on my desk today, was called Angry Moses, and featured a statement of Bernard's political beliefs carved on the back of it. The men became instant friends, bonded by their interests in politics, religion, history, and art. Bernard Zachheim was one of the most famous painters and sculptors in California. A proletarian artist who identified with struggling workers, he had studied with Diego Rivera in Mexico and painted murals at Coit Memorial Tower and the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco. His creations were invariably political in nature, and he was falsely accused of being a communist. Such a furor arose in 1934 over his work, and the work of other artists at Coit Tower, that authorities delayed the opening of the facility for several months. His murals at the medical center would eventually be removed, again in the midst of political controversy. Upon looking at one of Zachheim's paintings, Dad was so moved that he wrote a poem. This is an excerpt from the unpublished piece. What folly to think there is no place to receive this, no empty place for this painting to be, driven into the heart by the thing itself. We have a relationship, this artist and myself. His hand and my eye have just met. Dad had an ornate antique bathtub stored in the garage of our house. Several 100-pound sacks of concrete, to be used as boat ballast, were stowed in the tub, and in boxes and piles nearby were brass boat parts, ship-to-shore radio equipment and oars. These were things my father had picked up here and there, intending to build a sailboat one day to take around the world with his family. It would be a 45-foot catch, he said, and he planned to write stories aboard. He had taken celestial navigation classes recently with this in mind. Sadly, this dream, like many others of Frank Herbert, would never come to pass. We would move so many times in ensuing years, with no time or money to construct a boat, that the nautical items he had saved so carefully were discarded or sold. One symbol of our frequent moves was a waxed cardboard stencil, F. Herbert, with black paint smeared on it. Each time we moved, Dad used it to paint his name on our mailbox. As years went by and my father did more and more creative writing, this procedure with the stencil became increasingly important in order to make absolutely certain that the mailman did not miss our stop. Letters from agents and publishers, as well as checks, arrived in the mail. The mail became, to a large extent, the lifeline of our family. My mother said we moved sometimes to elude the first wife, Flora, who chased us tirelessly for past due child support payments. Invariably, Flora found out where we were, and a letter from her attorney would arrive soon afterward. One evening, my mother and father went to a speech on Jungian psychology at a Presbyterian church in Santa Rosa. The speaker, a clinical psychologist, was Irene Slattery, and as luck would have it, my parents sat in the audience next to her husband, Dr. Ralph Slattery. Ralph was the supervising clinical psychologist at Sonoma State Hospital, a sprawling 1,600-acre facility nearby. The Slatteries became our closest friends in Sonoma County. With respect to Frank Herbert's writings, the relationship with Ralph and Irene was extremely important. Going back to his days in college only 3 or 4 years before, my father had come to realize that an understanding of human motivation was the essential component of characterization. Now, with psychologists as friends, he would gain new insights. Dad had been interested in Carl Gustav Jung, the renowned psychologist and psychiatrist, for a number of years. Jung had known Dr. Joseph Banks Rhine, whose astounding experiments in the 1930s led Dad and a girlfriend at the time to dabble with ESP and the prediction of cards. Thinking there might be a link between ESP and what Jung referred to as the collective unconscious of mankind, my father subsequently studied this further in college. Now, more pieces were about to fall into place. In the 1930s, Irene Slattery had been a personal student of Jung at the Federal Polytechnical Institute in Zurich. She had her notes from those classes, along with papers provided by Jung, and Irene gave my father access to this information. Enthralled, he pored over everything written in English. Some of the notes and documents were in German, which Irene translated for him. She had been in Berlin in the 1930s, where she'd seen Adolf Hitler speak before thousands of people. Hitler terrified her from the moment she first gazed upon him. He was a skillful demagogue, she said, an expert at couching twisted, angry thoughts in words that sounded convincing. He was a hero to the German people, and terribly dangerous in that position, she felt, because of the way his people followed him slavishly, without questioning him, without thinking for themselves. Irene very nearly expressed this dangerous thought to the wrong people. Fortunately, she left Germany before getting into trouble and made her way to the United States. Years later, she related her early concerns about Hitler to Frank Herbert. Her thoughts about the danger of heroes simmered in Dad's highly receptive brain, and ultimately they would form a cornerstone of the Dune series. Heroes are dangerous, especially when people follow them slavishly, treating them like gods. Another cornerstone of the Dune series is the concept of genetically transferred memory, particularly in the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. This concept is based upon the teachings of Irene's professor Jung, who believed in a collective unconscious produced by genetic memory. The Slatteries were also interested in Zen Buddhism, a religious system emphasizing nonverbal interaction, understanding and saying things without words. This was my father's second exposure to Zen teachings, the first having occurred when he lived among Nisei as a child. A decade later, he would also meet the Zen master Alan Watts. Zen was an ideal adjunct to the Slattery's studies of Freud and Jung, where unconscious behavior was emphasized. In analyzing patients, the Slatteries paid close attention to mannerisms, what came to be called body language. The Zen influence permeates the Dune novels. Jung had been an early associate of Sigmund Freud before breaking with Freud over, among other things, Freud's insistence upon attributing neuroses to sexual disturbances. Dad had studied Freud extensively and believed in many of his hypotheses, particularly those that had to do with the subconscious motivations for human behavior. Irene and Ralph, too, agreed with many of Freud's hypotheses. Rather than accepting the teachings of any one psychologist, however, they preferred to select from the teachings and beliefs of many, including Jung, Freud, Alfred Adler, and others. Irene said something to me once, my father told me many years later, and I have thought of it often. When you see what motivates people, you will begin to see them walking around with their intestines hanging out. Now he was on a path that would lead to strong characterizations in his novels. In Santa Rosa, he began writing a novel, Under Pressure, about extreme psychological stress on board a nuclear submarine during wartime. The protagonist, a crafty, world-wise Bureau of Psychology officer, had unique insights into the problems of underwater warfare. Dad's title for the book, Under Pressure, had double meaning, the obvious submarine reference and the underlying psychological inference with respect to stresses exerted on the crew. In 1955, the novel would be published in hardcover as The Dragon in the Sea. Other Frank Herbert novels were based at least in part upon the Santa Rosa experience, including The Santa Rosa Barrier, 1968, about a town with a name that was a combination of two California towns, Santa Rosa and Saratoga. This novel described the mass psychology of people in the town and in the society at large, and had interesting philosophical themes, reflecting the influence of the Slatteries. On June 26, 1951, Mom gave birth to her second child, Bruce Calvin Herbert. By prior agreement, he would have a Scottish name. Mom named him after King Bruce, Robert I. I was a rather hyperactive child myself, and my father, when home, often lost patience with me. He was trying to write or complete extensive research. He needed quiet, contemplative time to consider important matters. I remember him yelling at me constantly, and if I didn't do exactly as instructed, he was quick to administer corporal punishment. At other times he enjoyed taking photographs of me, and one of the photos, of me standing at a mailbox trying to figure out how a chain beneath it could support it, was published in the Press Democrat. From my youthful perspective, however, there were more negative events than positive, and as years went by, we would become increasingly estranged. Unfortunately, he used Freudian methods when scolding his children. In addition to my own experiences, I saw him doing this with Penny when she came to stay with us, and later with my brother as well. Virtually every mistake we made, in his opinion, was intentional, motivated by some underlying subconscious element. Nothing was accidental in his view. Frank Herbert was a man who was so observant about affairs of the world that in his writings he would accurately predict epic events. But he didn't recognize his lack of closeness to his children when they were children. In that respect, his all-seeing eye had a blind spot. This superhuman of awareness, this hero in so many respects, who one day would become a hero to me, had an Achilles heel. He could not handle children. Perhaps this was because he had never really been a child himself. Assuming important responsibilities from a young age, he had been more of a miniature adult, with a keenly searching mind. His impatience with young people was perhaps his worst fault, the one that troubled me most. Children were noisy and boisterous, his bête noire. They clattered through the house and yard, driving him crazy when he tried to write, when he tried to think. They got into his desk and manuscript pages and smeared things around, much as Jules Verne's son Michel did to him. Dad had an oval face, on the fleshy side, with a weak chin and long blonde hair combed straight back, hair that was so light in color that it appeared thinner than it really was. His dark blue eyes had a way of flashing angrily at me when I was being scolded, and even when he smiled at me, it was with a penetrating intensity that I found unnerving. Sometimes he wore eyeglasses for reading or driving. They had round lenses with mottled brown frames. A burly, barrel-chested man, he had thick hair on his arms and chest. These features, combined with his loud and blustery ways, contributed to the primal display of the man from a child's perspective, making him a frightening, intimidating presence to me. Later, when he grew a full beard, he would look even larger.